Hello, this is Chuck Stevens, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 15th issue of the New York Times here on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. A big day, how the U.S. and the Arab world teamed up to seal the deal. The ceasefire talks in Egypt showed that the pressure on Hamas in Israel, seemingly huge impediments, could be overcome or at least set aside. The Egyptian intelligence chief was briefing a room full of negotiators on the state of play in the Gaza ceasefire talks when the Prime Minister of Qatar quietly slipped a handwritten note to Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff. The note urged the two Americans to push the Israelis to compromise. It was the morning of Wednesday, October 8th. Mr. Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law, and Mr. Witkoff, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East, had just arrived on a private plane in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, for what they hoped would be a breakthrough, at last, in the negotiations to bring an eventual end to Israel's two-year war with Hamas in the Gaza Strip. They had reason to be optimistic. For the first time, Hamas had signaled its readiness to release all the Israeli hostages without a complete withdrawal of Israeli forces, and as long as it received assurances Israel would not return to war. Giving up the hostages could deprive Israel of a reason to carry on the war, and Israel was ready to free thousands of Palestinians from its prisons, including 250 serving life sentences. But the talks were jammed. Negotiators who had been meeting for 2 days at the resort's Towns International Convention Center had shied away from pressing Israel and Hamas on a thorny question: how much territory in Gaza the Israeli military would leave before the hostage and prisoner exchanges. They feared that getting into the details of the map could derail the talks altogether. This account is based on interviews with 15 officials from the United States, Israel, and Arab governments involved in or briefed on the negotiations, all of whom insisted on anonymity, rather, to discuss private conversations and sensitive diplomacy. Both Israel and Hamas had taken maximalist positions. Hamas wanted Israel to pull out of Gaza entirely, except for a narrow buffer zone along its border. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wanted Israeli troops to stay entrenched in some cities in Gaza to show his public and his hardline ministers that he was making few concessions. Bridging that gap last Wednesday required steady American pressure on the lead Israeli negotiator, Ron Dermer, officials said, as the Qatari premier's note had urged. It also took 3 calls to the mediators from Mr. Trump himself, U.S. officials said. Mr. Dermer's office declined to comment. Hamas did not respond to a request for a comment. Ultimately, the two sides more or less split the difference. According to Arab officials, Israel would hold on to much more territory than Hamas wanted it to, but it would pull out of many built-up areas. Hamas grudgingly accepted the compromise, Arab and Israeli officials said. The mediators also knew that negotiating an agreement focused on the narrow issues of a ceasefire and hostage and prisoner exchange was more attainable than pushing for a grand deal that dealt with difficult questions around Israel's full withdrawal from Gaza and Hamas's disarmament. The success of Wednesday's talks, where earlier attempts had failed, reflected how, once enough pressure had been applied, seemingly huge impediments could be overcome, or at least set aside for later. In the past, the two sides had fallen back on absolutes. Israel insisted on total victory, and Hamas on a total Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. A big complaint from mediators about Israel in prior talks was that its negotiators never really had a mandate from Mr. Netanyahu, to make a deal. This time, the leaders of both delegations, Khalil al-Hayya, the top Hamas negotiator, and Mr. Dermer, came with a mandate to reach a deal, Arab and Israeli officials said. The talks were the culmination of dizzying weeks of diplomacy that began after the fallout over Israel's botched strike against Hamas officials meeting in Qatar. By late September, Mr. Trump had announced a 20-point plan that, while short on many details, specifically called for the release of all hostages in exchange for an Israeli pullback in Gaza. Crucially, on October 3rd, Mr. Trump chose to embrace Hamas's statement on his Gaza plan, even though it only offered support for part of his proposal, namely the exchange of hostages and prisoners. At the same time, he made clear that Israel would need to cooperate with its efforts to strike a deal or risk facing his wrath. Israel's botched strike in Qatar had created an opening to apply such pressure. But a senior U.S. administration official credited Mr. Trump's long-term approach to Israel with allowing him to prod the Israeli government in the direction of a deal. His staunch support gave confidence. The official said that Mr. Trump would not ask him to do anything that would compromise Israeli security. As for Hamas, 2 years of the Israeli military's offensive had left it severely weakened. Much of the Arab and Muslim world was now pressing Hamas, including key patron Turkey, whose intelligence chief was participating in the talks, and the militant group took seriously the threat that if it were seen as responsible for sinking Mr. Trump's plan, Israel would have a free hand from Washington to carry on attacking Gaza, Arab officials said. In the past, Hamas has insisted on holding on to some Israeli hostages as leverage unless Israel fully withdrew from Gaza and ended the war. But the group came to believe that holding the hostages was giving Israel legitimacy to continue fighting the war, according to senior U.S. officials. They were almost looking at the hostages less as an asset and more as a liability, Mr. Witkoff said. By Wednesday afternoon, in Sharm el-Sheikh, mediators felt they were finally getting close as they shuttled between Israeli and Hamas delegations. Under pressure from Mr. Witkoff and Mr. Kushner, Israel was showing more willingness to accept the middle ground on the withdrawal. The Israeli negotiators came around to thinking that while they would effectively be giving up control over Gaza, they could keep the other half to pressure Hamas to make more concessions in future talks about post-war governance, Israeli and Arab officials said. Mr. Al-Hayya, who had survived an Israeli assassination attempt weeks earlier in Doha, said he needed to consult with other members of Hamas's leadership. A convoy of black SUVs brought him and three other officials in the militant group back to their residence, Arab officials said. The Hamas officials were gone for so long that the Qatari prime minister instructed a top aide, Abdullah al-Salati, to chase them down at their residence, officials said. Mr. Al-Hayya was only ready to inform mediators of Hamas's decision at 10 p.m., 5 hours after they left the talks. By then, the Israeli, American, Turkish, Qatari, and Egyptian teams had already dispersed to their villas at the Four Seasons in Sharm el-Sheikh, a sprawling beachside resort. The Qatari Prime Minister, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman al-Thani, and the Egyptian intelligence chief, General Hassan Rashad, were sitting in General Rashad's villa when Mr. Al-Hayya approached, officials said. Mr. Al-Hayya told the mediators that even though Hamas considered the deal unfair, its priority was to stop Israel's bombing in Gaza, according to officials. Hamas, he said, still hoped the mediators would do everything they could to improve the deal for the Palestinians. Though cloaked in dissatisfaction, Mr. Al-Hayya's response was nonetheless clearly a yes. Both Mr. Thani and General Rashad began to sense that the longest war between Israel's and Palestinians might be ending and getting towards that conclusion. Minutes later, Mr. Witkoff and Mr. Kushner came to General Rashad's villa to hear the positive response and quickly related to the White House, the Arab officials said. Around that time, Mr. Witkoff held a quick but rare meeting with Mr. Al-Hayya, in which he said the United States will ensure that Israel upheld its commitments if Hamas followed through with its own, officials said. Axios first reported on the meeting. Some issues were still unresolved, like the names of Palestinian prisoners to be released by Israel and mediators debated the merits of announcing the deal right away. But the mediators concluded that the outstanding issues were not deal breakers and said that Mr. Trump could issue a statement announcing an agreement. In Washington, Mr. Trump was hosting an event at the White House when Secretary of State Marco Rubio passed him a note. Very close, the note said, "We need you to approve a Truth Social post soon so you can announce the deal first." Egyptian officials sitting alongside an Israeli intelligence official had finished making the final edits to the agreement's text. Mr. Al-Thani signed the agreement first before approaching Mr. Dermer with an English copy and separately Mr. Al-Hayaya with an Arabic one. At 1 a.m., one of the American negotiators took a call from Mr. Trump and put him on speaker so the president could address the room. "It's a big day," the president said. More from the New York Times front page. To meet pledges to save forests, spending must triple, a UN report says. 4 years after a global pledge to end deforestation, the amount of money going towards conserving and restoring forests is not enough, an analysis has found. Nations are not spending enough to ensure that the forests that cover nearly a third of the planet remain healthy, according to a new United Nations report. To meet various international climate, biodiversity, and land restoration goals, annual global spending needs to triple to $300 billion by 2030, the report found. Forests are the quintessential definition of a public good because of the benefits they provide, said Gabriel Labat, who leads the Climate Mitigation Unit at the UN Environmental Program and is one of the lead authors of the analysis. By providing habitat to more than 80% of all animals, plants, and insects on land, healthy forests are a key to sustaining life on Earth. They also help regulate weather patterns and the global climate. Trees and other plants absorb atmosphere-warming carbon dioxide as they grow, which offsets some of the greenhouse gases that are emitted from the burning of fossil fuels and are dangerously heating the planet. The report estimated that roughly 25 million acres are destroyed each year by human industries and extreme wildfires, which are increasing in frequency and intensity as the planet warms. In 2023 and 24, wildfires consumed some 78 million acres, an area roughly three times the size of Iceland worldwide. As a result, during those years, forests absorbed only a quarter of the carbon they captured 100 years ago. Governments from more than 140 countries signed a declaration at a UN climate conference in Glasgow in 2021, agreeing to halt or reverse deforestation by 2030. In 2023, the world spent some $84 billion protecting forests. The new report used a wide range of data to analyze as many sources of funding as possible, from governments and private institutions that protect all forest types, from tropical rainforests to boreal forests in the Arctic. There are many ways money can help a forest. For example, governments and aid programs or conservation groups may pay to protect wilderness areas from logging or to support tree planting efforts. The report found that private institutions like banks, venture capital firms, and corporations contribute less than a dollar out of every 10 that goes toward protecting or restoring forested areas. Governments provide all the rest. This means forests depend on a lot of taxpayer money, Mr. Labatt said. Most money for forest conservation and restoration comes from wealthier countries, with China and the United States accounting for nearly half of all funding, according to the report. Tropical countries, which tend to be less wealthy, but harbor some of the world's most vulnerable forests, spend the least. Many are burdened by debt and can't invest in conservation, said Francis Seymour, a senior policy advisor with the Woodwell Climate Research Center, a nonprofit organization. Farmers trying to make a living or politicians trying to stimulate the economy may end up supporting industries that cut down trees. It is in everybody's interest to protect the forest, said Ms. Seymour, but nobody gets paid for protecting a forest. International aid to help tropical countries is also lacking. Tropical countries spend an average 36 times as much money as they receive from the World Bank and various other global programs to save forests. The report found governments tend to spend within their borders, meaning countries prioritize conservation at home. In the private sector, companies that the UN considers likely to increase deforestation attract nearly $9 trillion in investment annually, more than 1,000 times the amount of private money spent protecting forests, according to the report. Agriculture, for instance, received some $400 billion in subsidies in 2023, but causes a lot of deforestation. In the Amazon rainforest, the equivalent of a football field is lost every 6 seconds to make room for expanding cattle ranches and soy farms. Carbon markets have emerged as a potential way to fund conservation. These are unregulated systems that let businesses offset a portion of their greenhouse gas emissions by paying for projects that protect or restore natural areas. But carbon credits represent only less than 2% of the money spent on forests, the report found. At the end of September, a coalition of 34 governments released a plan for financing forest conservation, meant to steer conversations at next month's UN climate conference in Brazil, known as COP30. The plan includes recommendations for improving carbon credits. The same week, Brazil announced it would invest $1 billion into the Tropical Forest Forever facility, a fund that would compensate countries for preserving tropical forests, setting aside 20% of the money for indigenous groups. The UN report found indigenous and local groups have been the most effective at protecting the world's forests, managing over a third of them, but they have received only 13% of global money for forest conservation. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times here on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And a reminder, you can enjoy all of our broadcasts whenever you want. They're available on all major podcast platforms. Governor Janet Mills of Maine to run for the Senate, aiming at Senator Susan Collins. A two-term Democratic governor, Ms. Mills called herself battle-tested in an interview, but she faces a Democratic primary before she can challenge the Republican incumbent. Janet Mills, the two-term Democratic governor of Maine, announced on Tuesday that she was running for Senate, aiming to unseat Senator Susan Collins, who is widely seen as the country's most vulnerable Senate Republican incumbent on the ballot in 2026. Ms. Mills, who is term limited, had been heavily recruited for months by Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the Democratic leader, who was eager to find a proven winner to take on Ms. Collins. Ms. Collins, at the age of 72, is a rare Republican to survive in her recent years in a Democratic-leaning state and is seeking her sixth term. The Maine Senate race begins as the Democratic Party's top pickup opportunity in 2026, with Ms. Collins, the lone Republican, up for re-election in a state that Donald J. Trump lost in 2024. Typically, a Democrat of Ms. Mills' stature would be warmly welcomed into such a contest. But other Democrats deferring to her. But Ms. Mills, 77, will find herself navigating a crowded primary, including against a 41-year-old oyster farmer and veteran named Graham Plattner. Despite having never previously run for office, Mr. Plattner has generated a national progressive following and raised $4 million in less than 2 months. The state's Senate primary is expected to be a test of some of the ideological and generational fault lines dividing the Democratic Party, as it finds itself locked out of power in Washington. If she wins next year, Mrs. Mills would be 79 at her swearing-in the following January, which would make her the oldest elected freshman senator in American history. It is a distinction the party is unlikely to highlight so soon after President Joseph R. Biden Jr. was pushed off the presidential ticket amid questions about his own age and acuity. In an interview over the weekend, Ms. Mills acknowledged the legitimacy of voter concerns about age and said it had been one factor she considered as she weighed whether to run. But she said the country's current situation calls for experience and the battle-tested electability she offers as the only Democrat to win a statewide race in Maine in the past 20 years. This is an urgent, unprecedented, dangerous moment in the country's history, and it demands more of every one of us, including me, she said. Defeating Susan Collins will be hard. The stakes are high, and we should leave nothing to chance. The issue of age could play differently in Maine, which has the oldest population of any state in the nation. Last month, Ms. Mills said in an interview that while she would retire and spend more time, rather, she could retire and spend more time with her five grandchildren, I'm not ready for that. I want to do something more. Ms. Mills is one of a trio of older, seemingly blue-chip recruits, along with former Governor Roy Cooper, 68 in North Carolina, and former Senator Sherrod Brown, 72 in Ohio, that Mr. Schumer has wooed into the 2026 elections. Yet the push for Ms. Mills in particular has faced some criticism inside the Senate. It's disappointing that some Democratic leaders are urging Governor Mills to run. Senator Bernie Sanders, who has endorsed and campaigned with Mr. Plantner, wrote on X last week, ahead of her expected entry into the race. Mr. Sanders urged Democrats to not waste millions on an unnecessary and divisive primary. Mr. Plantner predicted in a recent interview that the likelihood of losing is significantly higher with Ms. Mills rather than himself as the Democratic standard bearer because voters are so disgusted with the status quo. Going with someone who is very much of the establishment, going with someone who is very much of the party that has built the world we live in now, I think that runs a massive risk, Mr. Plantner said. I don't think it's about age at all. I think it's more about a way of thinking. It's about like a more ossified kind of politics that has just existed within the Democratic Party at this point for 30 to 40 years. A constellation of groups representing younger Democrats endorsed Mr. Plantner on Tuesday, including Leaders We Deserve, the group led by David Hogue, the former Democratic National Committee vice chair, who has prioritized bringing generational change to the party, and the College Democrats of America. Ms. Mills was immediately endorsed by Emily's List on Tuesday, the influential abortion rights group dedicating to electing women, and Senator Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada, a moderate Democrat. Mr. Plantner has already begun to draw relatively large crowds in town halls, and his campaign said he had more than 9,200 volunteers in the state. He has said he would not support Mr. Schumer staying on as a Democratic leader. Other declared Democrats in the race include Jordan Wood, a former congressional aide whose campaign said it had raised $3 million, Dan Klaben, a co-founder of the Maine Beer Company, dropped out of the race on Tuesday after Ms. Mills' entry and endorsed her. Ms. Collins has proved a particularly resilient campaigner. She had trailed in nearly every poll leading up to her 2020 race, yet won somewhat comfortably on Election Day. Ms. Mills has been around Maine politics for a half century, shattering glass ceilings in the state as the first woman elected as a district attorney, the first woman to serve as attorney general, and the first woman to serve as governor. She was also in the state legislature. She won re-election by double digits in 2022, defeating her predecessor as governor, Paul LePage. Ms. Mills, who was raised in rural western Maine in a family of politically active Republicans, counts Mr. LePage and Mr. Trump among the bullies she has faced down. Earlier this year, she sparred with Mr. Trump at the White House over the issue of transgender athletes, launching a feud that has simmered ever since. Mr. Trump has demanded that Maine comply with his order to keep transgender women off women's sports teams. Ms. Mills has refused to budge from her defense at the Maine anti-discrimination law that includes protections for gender identity. "See you in court," she told Mr. Trump at the White House. "Enjoy your life after governor because I don't think you'll be in electoral policies," Mr. Trump retorted. In an interview, Ms. Mills described their clash as a jaw-dropping moment. "That's not what the Constitution says," she said. "It doesn't give him authority to enact laws by press release." Since then, Ms. Mills said she has heard from many Maine voters urging her to run for Senate because they want to see a fighter in Washington with principled character. Ms. Mills' success in politically divided, largely rural state. Mills' success in a politically divided, largely rural state, where 46% of voters supported Mr. Trump in the last election, has been fueled by moderate positions. She oversaw some tightening of gun laws after the worst mass shooting in state history in 2023, but disappointed many liberals and progressives who had pushed for more sweeping reform. Ms. Mills has not kept up with a robust political presence online since her re-election. Her campaign's X account had not posted since the 2024 election, and her political Instagram account last posted celebrating her 2022 victory. The rust showed on Friday afternoon when her account accidentally posted and then deleted news of her Senate announcement and a fundraising page. The misfire was mocked online, including by operatives for the Senate Republicans align with Ms. Collins. The National Republican Senatorial Committee, in a sign perhaps that they would prefer not to run against Ms. Mills, released a one-minute video attacking her record on Tuesday. Maine Democrats are locked in a bruising fight between Chuck Schumer, out of touch as establishment, and Bernie Sanders' far-left radicals, said Joanna Rodriguez, a spokeswoman for the GOP committee. Ms. Mills and Ms. Collins have long maintained a friendly relationship, but in recent interviews, Ms. Mills took aim at the Republicans' voting record, including her support of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as health secretary and Linda McMahon as education secretary. Votes Ms. Mills said prioritized party loyalty over the well-being of the people of Maine. "I'm trying to preserve health care, and this man she voted for, RFK Jr., is tearing that apart," she said. "While I'm building up education, the secretary she voted for is tearing it down." Asked where she will find the energy to run a tough campaign while doing the demanding job of governor, Ms. Mills was blunt. "I'm pissed off," she said. "Every morning when I read the news and find out what happened, it pumps me up in a way I've never felt before." You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. A reminder, download our new app in your Google or Android app stores. It's free and very easy to use. Everything just with one touch of a finger. Next article, where Jews and Arab Americans live side by side with renewed hope. Detroit has one of the largest Arab American populations and a very vibrant Jewish community. Both groups feel some relief and lingering doubt. The question Rabbi Michael Moskowitz expected didn't come right away. At Temple Shir Shalom in suburban Detroit on Friday night, roughly 60 congregants had gathered in the sanctuary for Sukkot, the festival of Thanksgiving that commemorates the Israelites' desert wandering. A vaulted ceiling and blood wood framed the space, which held the cantor's voice in an aching reverberation. The ceasefire between Israel and Hamas had been announced just days earlier, setting the stage for the first wave of hostages to return and offering a tentative pause after 24 months of brutal conflict. The war, ignited by the killing of about 1,200 people in Israel, had claimed more than 67,000 people in Gaza, according to local health officials. Their tolls do not distinguish between combatants and civilians. For metropolitan Detroit, home to one of the largest Arab American populations in the United States and a vibrant, deeply rooted Jewish community, the ceasefire landed less as a celebration than as a shared, complicated quiet. Relief and joy mixed with mistrust. Hope was tempered by fatigue and worry. "Our tradition is one based on gratitude," Rabbi Moskowitz told his congregation. A year ago in Israel, Sukkot didn't really take place. People were in such pain, so exhausted, now, he said, they could find a moment simply to breathe. At the end of the service, the rabbi opened the door, or rather the floor, for questions. No one asked about the peace deal, the return hostages, or the future. The congregants filed out without articulating what everyone was surely thinking. I was waiting for it to come, Rabbi Moskowitz said later in a temple hallway. I thought for sure someone would ask, but none did. It was as if they didn't want to jinx the precarious moment, he said. Tessa Hewiston, age 21, standing with her mother in the temple's lobby, understood. This is also not committing to something that hasn't happened yet, she said. In Jewish tradition, she explained, families do not celebrate a pregnancy too early. You hold back until the good news is fully real. We're holding our breath, she said, not waiting, holding our breath. The distinction mattered, she said. Waiting is passive. Holding your breath is active. A choice to suspend yourself between one moment and the next. That was Friday. By Monday morning, that breath began to release. 20 living hostages crossed back into Israel. Video showed them stepping off buses embraced by family members, tears streaming down faces. At Temple Shir Shalom, Rabbi Moskowitz sent an email to his congregation. Overwhelmed and feeling such relief, he wrote, and even a little hope. The chairs that had stood on the temple lawn since October 2023, 251 at first, each representing a hostage, had become a constant witness. They have stood as a physical manifestation of our faith and our resolve, the rabbi wrote in the email. That evening, the congregation was gathered to remove 20 of them, he announced, one for each living hostage expected to return home. Tears fill our eyes, he wrote. Air fills our lungs. Our children are back home. About 18 miles south, skepticism ran deep in Dearborn Heights, where the Arab American community has strong roots. Aman Hassan Kwazini stood before the construction site that will soon be the new mosque for his longtime congregation, the Islamic Institute of America. Five golden domes, symbolizing the Prophet Muhammad and his family, had been lifted into place last week. Inside, thousands will eventually pray together. On Saturday, though, with the ceasefire announcement fresh, Aman Kwazini measured his words. I am glad to have an end to this devastating war, he said. The numbers haunted him. The tens of thousands dead in Gaza, about 2 million displaced, the orphans, the injured, the devastation of an entire territory, and now this deal brokered by President Trump, a man viewed with deep distrust in the Aman's community and by Arab Americans nationally. I have my doubts about whether Israel will follow through, Aman Kwazini said. He pointed to Lebanon, where past ceasefires had been declared, but missile strikes had continued. He mentioned a local heartbreak, a family with Michigan ties, all except one child, killed in an Israeli attack. There is a common belief in our community that the president is doing this, not because he is interested in peace in the Middle East, the Imam said about Mr. Trump's peace efforts. Rather, he is interested in a Nobel Peace Prize. Even if the ceasefire holds, he said, it's difficult to feel genuine happiness about Mr. Trump's role when the broader outcome may be a superficial peace agreement. Above him, the golden domes gleamed. The mosque is scheduled to open in a few months, God willing, the Imam said. For years, Rabbi Moskowitz and Aman Kwazini had been building a friendship. They shared meals and talked about bridging divides between their communities. When a white supremacist murdered 11 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh in 2018, Aman Kwazini came to Temple Shir Shalom to stand with the grieving community. Then came October 7th. The trauma was instant and absolute. Their connection went silent. Both men professed over the weekend their belief that their friendship could eventually return. The rabbi spoke of a necessary healing that still needed to happen before they could engage again. The Imam agreed, noting that the cleavage in their connection was a microism of a larger geopolitical stalemate. In the Detroit area, Jews and Arab Americans live side by side, work together, and send their children to the same schools. There has always been tension alongside remarkable coexistence. Now, that same closeness creates a different kind of tension. The strain of neighbors who carry opposing griefs, who read the same headlines and draw opposite, often painful conclusions. Saturday morning, Rabbi Moskowitz sat in a conference room at Temple Shir Shalom for his regular Torah study session with about a dozen congregants. The questions came quickly, a flood released after the stillness of Friday night. What about the Palestinian protesters on college campuses? Will there ever be a two-state solution? Aspirationally, I believe in that, Rabbi Moskowitz said about the two-state solution. I think that's what Israel needs ultimately to make it more secure. He noted roadblocks, an Israeli government that does not want such a setup, and questions about whether such a state could be trusted a trusted neighbor. How we get there, he said, I'm not sure. The rabbi rejected a one-state solution or the annexation of the West Bank as bad for Israel's long-term security. The conversation inevitably turned to Mr. Trump, the unlikely figure involved in securing the deal. Acknowledgement of the president's role seemed to come grudgingly from some in the room, a political concession extracted by reality. Rabbi Moskowitz relayed a conversation with a progressive religious teacher in Jerusalem who said, "How can we not thank Trump right now?" The rabbi said the teacher's feelings were shared by many. "We have to give thanks to President Trump for moving us in this direction. Israelis feel that way too." Rabbi Moskowitz continued, conveying his understanding of a reported back and forth between Mr. Trump and the Israeli Prime Minister, Netanyahu said, "People are going to like me again," and Trump said, "People are going to like Israel again. It's not about you." Rabbi Moskowitz, no fan of either leader, laughed wryly. I mean, the narcissist is calling out the narcissist. The most difficult query came from a congregant who asked directly about the innocent lives lost in Gaza. The rabbi confirmed what he had stated during prayers the night before. They mourned all innocent lives, Israeli and Palestinian both, because this is what Jewish values require. He cited the ancient concept of tzedek tzedek terdof, a Hebrew phrase meaning justice, justice shall you pursue, asserting that pursuing justice demands acknowledging the humanity of those on the other side. Detroit's Jewish and Arab American communities continue to exist in parallel, actively suspending themselves between trauma and solace, happiness, and whatever comes next. People are all holding their breath, waiting to see what is going to happen in the future, said Dave Abadala, a regular at the mosque. True coexistence is worth the work, Mr. Hewitson said. It's going to be tough, but everybody is ready. We're committed to hope. It's the only chance we have. Monday evening, as the sun set, more than 100 congregants gathered on the lawn of Temple Shir Shalom for ceremony. The chairs there had stood throughout this ordeal, through rain and snow, tough negotiations that failed and negotiations that succeeded. Rabbi Moskowitz called forward 24 children. Miss Houston helped direct them. The children each took one chair, 20 for the living hostages who had returned home that day, 4 for the bodies that had been recovered. 24 chairs came down. 24 remained on the lawn, representing hostages whose bodies were still in Gaza, their families still waiting for closure. Prayers for peace continue at the synagogue and the mosque. Separated by miles and months of silence, two men who were once friends wait for the day when connection becomes possible again. And for now, the ceasefire holds. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, always available by listening live at nfradioreading.org, and of course, content available on all major podcast platforms. Our next article from the New York Times, Trump's trade war with China catches the world in its crossfire. Tariffs and other restrictions between the United States and China are reverberating in unpredictable ways. One of the world's main number crunchers released its latest economic report Tuesday. But the middling forecast from the International Monetary Fund doesn't begin to capture the helter-skelter ride that the global economy is on. Even as the IMF was preparing its report, a flurry of developments were already altering the picture. New U.S. tariffs on imported wood, furniture, and kitchen cabinets that are expected to drive up the cost of home building took effect on Tuesday. So did the opening round of higher port entry fees that China and the United States will impose on each other's vessels. Tuesday's turn of the trade wheel was just one click in a series of repercussions set in motion by President Trump's vow to smash the world's economic order. More will follow. Last week, Beijing decided to sharply step up curbs on its export of rare earth metals, materials that are essential for the manufacturing of semiconductors, cell phones, wind turbines, and nearly every other modern gadget. New restrictions on equipment needed to produce batteries for electric cars are also scheduled to take effect next month. Mr. Trump's initial fury softened over the weekend after his response led to the sharpest decline in stocks since April, when the president's initial barrage of tariffs was announced. Still, his threat to slap an additional 100% tariff on Chinese imports was left dangling. The U.S.-China relationship is highly volatile, said Richard Portes, a professor at the London Business School. One doesn't really know what to expect from one day to the next, and that's typical of the current administration. The souped-up tension between the two economic superpowers is catching other countries, that is, almost every country, in the crossfire. China's restrictions on metals and magnets, for instance, would affect European automakers that use those materials and ship them across borders within Europe. And the levies on ships made in China apply even to non-Chinese shipping companies stopping at American ports. On Tuesday, the Chinese government ratcheted up the retaliation by adding five American subsidiaries of the South Korean shipping company Hanwha to its sanctions list, accusing the subsidiaries of supporting and assisting the United States in its moves in the shipbuilding industry. Beijing and Washington are also essentially pressuring nations around the globe to take sides. Mexico, one of the world's biggest buyers of Chinese cars, proposed a 50% tariff last month on those vehicles after heavy lobbying from the Trump administration. India, meanwhile, has moved closer to China since the White House, piqued by New Delhi's continued purchase of Russian oil, imposed tariffs up to 50% on Indian goods. In August, Prime Minister Narendra Modi visited China for the first time in 7 years to attend a security and economic conference, a public display by India's leader that his country has plenty of allies should the Trump administration continue to single it out for punishment. Since Mr. Trump took office, shifts in global trade policy have happened both at high speed and in slow motion, reverberating in broad and unpredictable ways. When Mr. Trump announced his plan this summer to slap 50% tariffs on most steel and aluminum coming into the United States, British steelmakers felt lucky. Their government had already struck a deal that their steel would be tariffed at only half that amount, 25%. But the mood in Britain darkened considerably last week when the European Union announced its own set of punishing tariffs on steel imported into its 27-nation bloc. The policy delivered a gut punch to Britain's steel industry, which sends nearly 80% of its exports to the European Union. Britain, though, wasn't the target of the policy, just a bystander to moves aimed at Beijing and Washington. The 50% EU tariff was directed at China, which has been accused of dumping underpriced steel on the global market. The tax was also designed with an eye to putting the European Union in a better negotiating position with the United States. The union is ready to work with like-minded countries with a view to ring-fencing their economies for global overcapacity, the European Union's executive arm said last week. We will continue exploring ways of working together with the U.S. The protectionist impulse is also going viral, with Canada, Brazil, and Mexico taking steps to shield their homegrown steelmakers. Despite the frequent swerves in trade policy, the global economy will remain highly integrated, said Lucretia Rechlin, a professor at the London Business School, even as the center of gravity shifts towards Asia and away from the West. For now, growth is slowing in both the United States and China, with a pervasive unpredictability characterizes the short and long-term outlooks. Mr. Portes at the London Business School summed up the dynamic between the world's two largest economies. China has stable, clear, and determined objectives. The Trump administration changes from day to day in its views and its policies. The degree of uncertainty is huge, he added, and that has consequences for the global economy. You're listening to articles and features from the New York Times here at the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In more politics, explosive accusations shaking up New Jersey's governor race. Representative Mickey Schirrell, a New Jersey Democrat, said a firm once owned by her Republican opponent, Jack Citarelli, spread misinformation about opioids. His campaign has threatened to sue her for defamation. The race for New Jersey governor has taken a sharp, unexpected turn less than a month before Election Day, with the opioid crisis taking center stage amid explosive charges by Democratic nominee Representative Mickey Schirrell. The latest twist in the race came on Monday when Ms. Schirrell, joined by a substance abuse counselor and a man whose brother overdosed on prescription painkillers, again blamed her Republican opponent, Jack Citarelli, for spreading misinformation about opioids. Her words were far more nuanced than the stunning assertion she made last week during a debate in which she accused Mr. Citarelli of being responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of people. But her central claim was unchanged, that a medical publication company that Mr. Citarelli owned until 2017 had made it easier for people to get prescription opioids. During Wednesday's debate, Ms. Schirrell said, "You killed tens of thousands of people by printing your misinformation, your propaganda, and then getting paid to develop an app so that people could more easily get the opioids once they were addicted. You then went on to kill tens of thousands of people in New Jersey, including children," she added. "It's a lie," Mr. Citarelli responded. "I'm proud of my career." Mr. Citarelli's campaign has flatly denied the charge and said it planned to take a rather fiery defamation lawsuit against Ms. Schirrell this week, baselessly and recklessly accusing a political opponent of mass murder in a televised debate crosses the line, Chris Russell, Mr. Citarelli's chief strategist, said. The campaign has twice before threatened to sue over unrelated issues, but has yet to follow through. But Ms. Schirrell's rhetoric has nonetheless inserted a volatile new element into a race that has drawn an extraordinary amount of money and interest from national Democratic and Republican Party leaders, who are hoping to demonstrate strength in New Jersey on November 4th. The contest, one of just two governor's races this year, is considered an early test of voter attitudes toward President Trump ahead of the 2026 congressional races. Both candidates have intensified their negative attacks in recent weeks, and each has accused the other of selectively splicing video footage to create misleading ads. According to most polls, Ms. Schirrell, a former Navy helicopter pilot, is the frontrunner. But her abrupt departure from an otherwise carefully curated campaign message has left Republicans suggesting that the race is far closer than surveys suggest. It has also brought renewed attention to Mr. Citarelli's career as a publisher in the medical field, whose company Galen Publishing produced material for universities and other clients, often with money supplied by pharmaceutical companies. Here's what we know about Ms. Sherrill's claims, Mr. Citarelli's business, and an online tool his company helped to create that was known as Living with Pain. Opioid overdose deaths in New Jersey and nationwide surged between 2012 and 2018. During those years, 11,107 New Jersey residents died from overdoses of prescriptions and illicitly produced opioids, including heroin, according to State Health Department data. When asked about Ms. Sherrill's claim that Mr. Citarelli had killed tens of thousands of residents, her spokesperson cited the additional 12,837 opioid deaths in New Jersey since 2018 after Mr. Citarelli sold his company. Galen Publishing was a medical educational company focused on producing journals and developing content for continuing education programs in association with universities. It did not manufacture opioids. Living with Pain was not an app, but a collection of interactive online video modules. It's now defunct, and the New York Times was unable to independently verify its contents or view any of the roughly 70 to 100 videos that were set to be included on the website. The Citarelli campaign said it did not have the videos, noting that Mr. Citarelli had not owned the company for 8 years. They do not turn up in a search of the internet. The site was created to help patients start the conversation with their doctor and take control of their pain, according to an email from a manager at Teva Pharmaceuticals, a company that manufactured generic opioids and funded the online tool. Mr. Russell, Mr. Citarelli's strategist, said that Mr. Citarelli's company had helped to create an online tool aimed at helping chronic pain sufferers educate themselves on treatment options. Sherrill can't provide any evidence of her reckless claim that Jack's publishing company pushed people toward opioids because it never ever happened, Mr. Russell said on Monday. Living with Pain, Advanced Studies in Medicine, a component of Mr. Citarelli's company Galen Publishing, received $139,800 in funding from Teva Pharmaceuticals to work on what became known as Living with Pain, according to internal corporate documents compiled by the University of California at San Francisco and Johns Hopkins University. The repository of records offers a searchable database of documents from pharmaceutical companies that were turned over in opioid lawsuits. Living with Pain started in August of 2016 and was designed to help patients with chronic pain take a more active role in symptom and medicine identification/treatment, according to an internal PowerPoint presentation provided during litigation over claims that Teva contributed to the opioid crisis. A payment spreadsheet submitted in connection with the lawsuit noted that the program was supposed to end in June of 2018. Advanced Studies in Medicine helped develop the online tool in collaboration with another company, ProPatient, and with the U.S. Pain Foundation, a nonprofit advocacy organization helping people with conditions causing chronic pain, according to the PowerPoint presentation. The U.S. Pain Foundation has accepted millions of dollars from pharmaceutical companies. According to the email from Teva manager, Mr. Citarelli's company was expected to introduce the Living with Pain interactive tool to healthcare providers who would be encouraged to provide their patients with access to the site. It was ProPatient that operated a companion mobile app that allowed patients to download checklists and customize questions for doctor according to the presentation. Living with Pain was released just as the federal government was taking new steps to try to reduce opioid prescriptions amid rising overdoses and deaths. In 2016, following months of arguments with drug industry groups, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released guidelines urging doctors to first recommend pain relievers such as ibuprofen before prescribing opioids. In turn, some patients with chronic pain had a harder time obtaining the medicines that ease their suffering. Pharmaceutical companies have since paid billions of dollars in jury verdicts and to settle lawsuits seeking to hold them responsible for the deadly opioid epidemic. Teva settled in 2022 with states and local governments to a deal worth up to $4.25 billion. In 2016, Teva anticipated that perhaps 15,000 patients might use living with pain as a resource, according to the internal email. But when it was released, the online tool was hardly a runaway hit. In the 2 weeks after it was introduced, only 34 people had created an account, and there were 143 guest users, according to the PowerPoint presentation turned over in litigation against Teva. Officials with Teva and ProPatient did not respond to requests for comment. The chief executive of the U.S. Pain Foundation, Nicole Hemingway, said in an email that her organization did not have a relationship with any of the groups involved in the Living with Pain project and did not have access to the videos. Galen Publishing produced journals bearing the name of Johns Hopkins University, among other universities. It held a long-running contract with the University of Tennessee Health Science Center and its College of Pharmacy. There were webcasts, symposiums, and an academic journal, according to a letter by a University of Tennessee official. As was common for medical education companies, funding, more than $13 million over nearly a decade, came from pharmaceutical giants: Bristol-Myers, Squibb, Pfizer, Purdue Pharma, Teva, Gilead Sciences, and Merck, among others. Mr. Citarelli, a former state assemblyman, sold Galen Publishing in 2017, netting him millions and giving him time to focus on running for governor. This is his third race for the office. Dr. G. Caleb Alexander, a professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, helps to manage the archive of opioid litigation documents and testified as an expert witness for government entities that sued in connection with the opioid crisis. Dr. Alexander said he was not familiar with the specifics of Ms. Sherrell's claims or Mr. Citarelli's business. But he said that in general, medical education companies grossly overstated the benefits of opioids and understated their risks. Were they on the wrong side of the epidemic? I think most people would say yes, Dr. Alexander said. But he said that it would be wrong to attribute a certain number of deaths to any individual medical education company. It's just a complex and fraught undertaking to attribute a certain amount of harm to this or any other communications company, he said. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 15th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Chuck Stevens. Thank you for listening.